section of Brooklyn, New York.
He's a three-time world heavyweight champion who ruled by intimidation.
Beat me if you can. Survive if I let you.
Taz would pick up guys nearly twice his size and drop them on their heads.
He is a human suplex machine.
Now he's bringing his no-nonsense New York swagger to the podcast world. This is Taz.
The mood is about to change.
The Human Podcast Machine.
All right, guys, what's going on? What's up? What's up? This is the Human Podcast Machine. My name is Taz, and thank you for downloading or subscribing to the podcast. I do appreciate it. Everything's going real well. We're just rocking and rolling. And this particular episode, very excited, special guest. We're gonna talk to the head man of the Beatdown Clan, the BDC from Impact Wrestling, MVP, the one and only, always balling MVP of the BDC, a lot of letters, MVP. And we got an interesting topic, and I think MVP is the perfect cat to talk to, and that's about Japanese professional wrestling, the power over the years and the popularity of pro wrestling in the great country of Japan, the land of the rising sun. So MVP and I will jump into that in just a little bit. I just want to give a congratulations to the WWE. Their network hit 1 million subscribers, and that's something, as everybody knows, they've been trying to do. So congrats to them. It was interesting because the day after the Royal Rumble, there was this whole big campaign online of, hey, cancel WWE Network. And then WWE puts out an interesting Raw because of the snowstorm, the blizzard that hit the Northeast. They're supposed to have a show in Connecticut, a live Raw. And as everybody knows, they couldn't do it because it was canceled, or postponed, I should say. And they ended up doing some exclusive interviews, sit-down interviews with some of the talent on Raw from the WWE headquarters, which, people thought was very cool. I thought it was cool. I mean, I didn't think they were reinventing the wheel there. I thought it was cool. I kind of was tweeting a little bit because I felt like there was a lack of energy the way they were producing these sit-down interviews. Some of it seemed a little forced and contrived. I thought Daniel Bryan came off real good. I thought he came off kind of real. Obviously, Paul Heyman came off very real. I thought Roman Reigns, who, unfortunately for this kid, he's like public enemy number one in WWE land. You know, he came off a little bit like it was written for him, and he came off kind of disingenuous. Not ripping on the kid. I'm pulling for the kid. I like Roman Reigns. I know he's being force-fed, and I covered this on a podcast on my Royal Rumble recap. But I'm going to get into that right now because you could download that if you want to hear it. But the thing is, man, I think he came off very, I don't think he meant to, but he might have got more heel heat than he did after the push they gave him at the Royal Rumble. So, I think that part of that is the writing. Part of that is the micromanaging. Part of that is you're in a studio. Vince McMahon is hawking over you. And it's threatening for some of the guys. And you could sense the lack of comfortability. I felt, just is my opinion. So you could agree with me or disagree. It's your call. I'm just giving my opinion. So my opinion, I felt like the announcers seemed a little tense, especially Michael Cole. He seemed very, like he was doing dry news again. I think Vince McMahon is right there hawking over the guys. I've seen it. Been to this movie before, and it creates a tense environment, and I really believe that came off. That's just my opinion, my feelings on watching that Raw show. I thought the concept was cool, doing some exclusive interviews. They're making chicken salad out of chicken shit because the show got canceled, postponed. I keep saying canceled, I meant postponed. So, I think they did a good job creatively with that mindset. But at the end of the day, this is my opinion. It seemed like the public, for the most part, loved it. And again, WWE hit 1 million subscribers on their network. So congrats to them. That's the bigger picture, to be honest. And in this episode, as I said, we're going to have MVP here shortly. And also, the Taz tale will be about my finishing school, which I'm going to give you the details of what happened and why it kind of didn't go forward with it, the mindset of why I created it. For those that remember it, I mean, I'm very proud of guys like Bull Dempsey rocking and rolling with WWE's NXT and Will Ferrara with Ring of Honor, who's doing great stuff. They were products out of my dojo, the finishing school. So we'll get into that shortly. And real quick, want to talk, because I didn't do it in my Royal Rumble recap, unfortunately. I just had a brain fart. That happens, and I'm being honest about it. That the best match on the card was that three-way match at the Royal Rumble with Lesnar, Seth Rollins, and John Cena. Tremendous contest. Best match on the card. Seth Rollins showed he is who he is. This kid is legit. No doubt. I remember back in the day, years ago, when I first came to TNA, I told Vince Russo, who was the lead writer, and I just came to TNA, I said, dude, have you ever seen this guy Tyler Black from Ring of Honor? He's like, yeah, no, he's great. I go, yeah, I know. And I guess I fell between the cracks. I'm like, if there's an opportunity to get him, if he's not under contract, I didn't know his deal. And I kind of just gave an opinion. I never met Tyler Black, who's now Seth Rollins, yet to meet this guy, but big fan of his work. And I thought this freeway really, really showed what he's about. Ring of Honor fans know what he's about. You know, and you saw it for the casual WWE fan or the casual wrestling fan or a TNA fan that doesn't watch much WWE. If you saw the Royal Rumble and you saw that three-way, you saw what Seth Rollins is about. You saw John Cena bust his ass as always, and he did. People, you know, people get on Cena a lot. That guy was doing, you know, going for these, what do they call them now? AAs, like the attitude adjustment, when he fireman carries the guy and then dumps him to the side, his finishing move. He was lifting guys like Lesnar, a guy like Lesnar, very late in the match several times. That takes a lot of energy and strength. Very tough to do what Cena did there. And just his effort, he always puts out great effort, John. There's no doubt about that. And Lesnar doing all these suplexes was interesting. I even tweeted during the show, I think, like, where's the office heat that I got back in 2000 for doing suplexes? And Lesnar, who I love, he's throwing these two guys all over the place nonstop. You know, geez. But you know what? It was impressive. And Brock ended up retaining the WWE Championship in that three-way match. I thought it was a great match. I really did. I enjoyed it. Those guys busted their ass. It was great stuff. All right, look, enough of that stuff. We're coming right back real quick right here with the leader of the Beast DC, the Beatdown Clan's own MVP.
Hey, the Human Podcast Machine will be right back.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
John Studd, my middle name Mud. Dirty water flow, too much for you thug. That can't stand the flood. What up, Doc? Whole big gun like Elmo.
All right, here we go, boys and girls. Gonna bring in my man of the hour here. Check this out, man. His success, not just in the United States, but in the great country of Japan. I mean, this guy is a former IWGP Intercontinental Champion. PWI, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, ranked him number 23 out of the best 500 wrestlers in the country. I mean, his success in the WWE, not just TNA as of current, but the WWE Tag Team Champion with none other than Matt Hardy, a WWE United States Champion, Dos, two times. He is MVP. My man, what's going on?
Man, Taz, it's an honor to be on the air with you, man. This is beautiful. Been looking forward to this for a long time. You and I to be able to sit down and just talk a little pro-res head-to-head.
Pro-res. Yeah, a lot of people don't realize pro-res is kind of how it rolls over there in the land of the rising sun. That's what they call it, pro-res. And, you know, you and I, look, we've been through a lot of the same circles our time in WWE together. When I was a commentator, you were a grappler, and obviously in TNA as of current. And you know, you're a Miami street guy. I'm a New York street guy. There's some parallels there, except we didn't have any palm trees where I grew up. You know what I'm saying?
Just plastic ones, right?
Yeah, the blow up ones you get at Party City. But no, bro.
Yeah, there you go. Bro, no pink flamingos in the yard.
No, there was no pink flamingos. You guys had some pink flamingos and some cap guns too, but I digress. So, because you didn't grow up in like you didn't grow up like in the plush area of Miami, bro. Right? Not hanging out on the white sandy beaches of Miami. That's not where you grew up in that part of Miami, right?
Not at all, man. I grew up in an area called Opa-locka, which do a little research. At one point, it was the murder capital of the world. It was a drug haven. As a matter of fact, I like to tell people, Johnny Cash, when he does his song, I've Been Everywhere, one line, he says, I've been to Opa-locka. And there's only one reason Johnny Cash went to Opa-locka, and that was to get his dope, because that's the only thing that was in Opa-locka. Dope and death. Nothing else.
Oh, that's good stuff right there. there's some insight about Johnny Cash, the man in black, I never knew. But
there you go.
No, but check it out, man. Like, your history, very unique, the way you came up, you know, kind of over your years as a kid, growing up the hard way, bro, and I know what that's like, and then segueing into the business. Let's give a quick overview before we get into our topic of the popularity of pro wrestling in Japan, because you are not just a competitor, but an expert on that, the Japanese topic of pro wrestling. But for those people that were nice enough to download the Human Podcast for seeing my show right here and listen to this episode with MVP, give them a little background of you and how you came up, where you broke in, all that jazz.
Man, the Reader's Digest version. I grew up in Miami. And you know, I had a chip on my shoulder. I was an asshole. But actually, prior to that, you know, I was always a pretty good kid, you know. And my dad was actually a cop, but he wasn't around much. So, you know, kids blossom in the wrong ways or bloom in the wrong ways if they're not nurtured right. And, you know, I started running the streets, and I grew up in Miami. I tell people all the time, during the era of Miami Vice, when I was 9, I knew what a Rolex Presidential was, I knew how much it cost, and I knew I wanted one, and I knew I'd never get one working a 9-to-5 like my mother and father. So I wanted to go get it, like I saw other people going to get it. And, man, that turned into gangs and guns and drug selling, you know, stupid shit that a kid goes through at 14, 15, 16 that a kid shouldn't be into.
Right.
And I did about 6.5 months in a juvenile facility for robbery. I got out. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. Robbery,
yeah, I'm sure.
Aggravated assault, grand theft auto, resisting arrest.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Nice run down.
Yeah. Well, that's as they call it, life experiences. No, but like, no, but don't check it out, bro. See, the thing is, but hold on. The thing is, like, where you grew up. You know, I grew up in the same type of environment. Don't take this wrong way. I didn't make those that heavy of mistakes, but I made mistakes. But I knew my boys made a lot of those, had those same issues. And the thing is, when you grow up around that, MVP, and you know this, you can attest to this. When you grow up around that, that's all you know, right or wrong.
Yeah, well, in my case, I knew better. I just made, and this is what I want to stress, what you said about making mistakes. I didn't make a mistake. I made a conscious decision to do the fucked up stuff that I did. It was no mistake.
Right.
It was a bad decision. I didn't, you know, a mistake is something you do accidentally. I didn't accidentally stick a shotgun in somebody's face and say, give me your money or I'll kill you.
Right.
It was a conscious decision that I made knowing the consequences for my actions. Because like you said, you grow up in an area where you see this going on, you know a lot of people that have been or are going to prison. And you know that's just part of the life cycle if you choose that path.
Of course.
So I knew that that's something that potentially waited for me. But, you know, nobody ever thinks they're going to get caught, right?
Of course. Well, no, right. But you've turned yourself around, obviously, immensely back in the day. I mean, and bring us to that positive side of that turnaround.
Well, I'll tell you, I ended up getting out of that juvenile facility. I stayed out 6 months, and then I went back in for another armed robbery. Me and some guys robbed a casino on a cruise ship. It was pretty pretty flamboyant, some Ocean's 11 type thing. One of the guys.
Oh, whoa, wait. Wait, I didn't know that. Hold on. You you turned over a casino boat. You serious?
I'm not exaggerating, man.
Oh, bro.
We pulled a real lick.
Bro, you're gonna tell you something. You're gonna do some shit. That's how you do it. Oh man, you're crazy. Wow. Ocean's 11.
As a kid, man, you know, I started off, you know, just doing little street robberies and then, you know, jacking street drug dealers and then, you know, did a few grocery stores and, you know, a bank or two along the way. And man, I was just a wild kid. I didn't care. And like I said, I did about 6.5 months. I got out. I did this big caper. And one of the dudes involved ratted. And I kept my mouth shut, so I'm the one that caught the hardest bid. I ended up with an 18.5-year sentence, of which I served 9.5. And while I was at work release, I met a correctional officer. Shout out to my dude, Primetime Daryl D.
All right.
Who he said, "Hey man, you know, if you want to start training, you know, I would ask him questions about wrestling because he'd bring in videotapes to show us in the morning before we were able to go out to work." And man, how do you guys, you know, break, you know, body slam each other and then didn't superplex each other without killing each other for real? You know? And he's like, "Man, when you get out, if you want to learn, I'll teach you." And I said, "All right, I need a hobby." And you know, that was my destiny, man. It was the beginning of the end. I had no idea.
Wow.
One of the beautiful things is, a shout out to you, it was around that time when I was at Work Release, the ECW was experiencing this crazy awakening. And I just my interest in pro wrestling because of primetime had been rekindled. So I was locked up. I missed the Monday Night Wars. You know, I missed out on all that. And I remember seeing this WWE commercial. The only dude in it that I recognized was Undertaker. And I was like, oh, man, Undertaker's still going. That's pretty cool. I didn't know anybody.
Right.
And I was listening to a late night talk radio show. And I don't remember what it was called, but everybody that called into that show was talking about ECW. When's ECW going to be available in my area? That's all anybody talked about. And you were the guest caller. I'd never met you, never seen you. I didn't know anything about you, but I said, man, I like this dude's style.
Well, thanks, man. I never knew that. All the years I know you, I never knew that, man. That's, wow, that you just made me blush. That's cool, man. Well, no, just to hear that from someone, not just a fellow wrestler and someone from the business, but from a guy with your success as a sports entertainer and a pro wrestler, you know, just to hear that makes me proud. You know, I mean, that really does. That I could, I'm just,
oh, yeah,
yeah, that's
man.
Cool, man. That's cool.
Yeah, I'll tell you, man, really, you know, just because, you know, not a mutual ass-kissing session, but a mutual respect session.
Word.
I like the way you came across on the air. And then when I actually saw you, you know, I go, man, the human suplex machine, Survive If I Let You. Like, damn, I'm big this dude, man.
Yeah.
What's up, man?
Thank you, man. Well, and, it was cool. I had a lot of help along the way, but I digress. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, at that time, when it was funny, we used to come back to the Work Release on Saturday nights. I used to go to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a way to get out of the institution for the night. And we would come back to the Work Release Center. It would be during count time. So it worked out perfectly because everyone has to go to their rooms during count, and the guys coming back into the center, they would lock us in the TV room until count was done.
Wow.
So there's an unwritten rule in prison. A TV program that's already in progress, you can't change it. So it worked out perfectly. I would put on the TV, and by the time count was cleared and guys came out, ECW was just starting. And guys would walk in and want to change the channel, and I'd have to, you know, literally stand up and be like, nah, man, we going at it. And the first week, it was, you know, a handful of guys in there like, oh, man, this old dumbass wrestling shit, man. Oh, like, man, are you watching this? By the end of the month, it was standing room only. Oh, man, wrestling coming on, man. Hey, man, you better change that, man. Put that wrestling on, man.
Dude, I was going to say to you, I would think that a bunch of hard-ass dudes in the joint had to be digging old-school ECW. I would think that they would have loved it, honestly.
No, they came around. They came around in the beginning. In the beginning, it was dismissed. Oh, this is bullshit. But, you know, after seeing, you know, suicidal, homicidal, genocidal, and super crazy, and human suicide. This was, and I remember my first time seeing it. I'm saying, man, what happened to pro wrestling? What happened to headlocks and body slams? Like, man, these dudes are getting suplexed on their head, razor wire around the ring. You know? So, yeah, but by the time it was all said and done, there were some hardcore ECW fans at Opa-locka Work Release Center.
Oh, man, that's very cool. I didn't know that. So then, you came out in a primetime, help gave kind of introduced you to physically how this is done. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, man, I got out, and he called me about a month after I got out and said, hey, you still want to train? I said, yeah. He said, hey, well, you just got out, you did a long ride, and you know, enjoy being home for a little while. I'll call you in another month or two. And he did. He had a ring set up in his backyard, and I had my first lesson. And, man, you know, as the saying goes, I stepped in shit. Like, hey, man, I like this. I can do this. And at the time, it's funny because I was married back then. And my wife used to see me rolling out of bed, beat up, barely able to walk. And she said, why are you doing this to yourself? And I said, baby, I can't tell you. I like it. You know, and at the time, I had no designs on becoming, you know, a WWE star going to Japan. I mean, this was the very beginning. And she said to me, all right, well, if you're still doing this in 6 months, I'll take you serious. And, you know, here we are 10 years later. Now, actually, wait a minute. I'm lying to you. What I got, 99, 2014 years later.
Wow.
Still at it, going on 15.
Wow, man. Well, good for you. And how did you go from working in some ring with Primetime and learning headlocks and arm bars and how to bump, you know, to segueing into the WWE? Because I remember, like, you know how it is when you work for WWE. You're kind of stuck in that crazy world where once you leave the building, you kind of, I don't mean this in a bad way, but I think you'll connect to what I'm saying. You kind of leave the business behind when you leave work. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of, yeah, you know the deal. So that's kind of how it was for the announcers, too. Like, I would leave and not... Really, I don't want to say it the wrong way, like I wasn't passionate, but I would not pay attention to anything else that went on in the wrestling business except for WWE, because it was a full plate as it was. And I felt like you came aboard seemingly out of nowhere with gangbusters. I remember Vince McMahon saying in a production meeting, an announcers meeting with Michael Cole, like, yo, this guy here, meaning you, MVP, this guy's got something that I like. He says about him. He goes, we need to treat him a little different. You know what I mean? And so you triggered the right guys, as you know.
Yeah, well, that's praise from Caesar, you know, coming from Vince,
right,
as you very well know. But,
yep.
Dude, in my case, when I started training, Norman Smiley was still with WCW.
All
and
right.
He was, you know, he was from Miami. And, you know, all the local guys, all the guys that we trained under, everybody knew Norman. And periodically... As a matter of fact, Primetime, the dude I started training with, he had a ring in his backyard. He had to take it down. And Duke the Dumpster had a wrestling school.
Huh.
And Soul Man Alex G, who used to be with Global, part of Soul Patrol, he had taken over training duties because Duke was hardly ever there. So as a favor to Primetime, Alex started training me. And as Norman would come around, you know, he would work with us a little bit, and for some reason he took me under his wing, and Norman showed me Japanese wrestling for the very first time.
Ah.
Norman spent some time over in UWF.
Yep.
You know, that three-quarter shoot promotion.
Shoot promotion. Yep.
And, man, the very first time I saw Misawa give Kawada a Tiger Driver 91, right after I cringed and winced, I said, I want to do that.
Yeah.
So, I was like, that's what I want to do, that style. And, man, I shortly thereafter, you know, and we're going back to the, you know, early 2000s, everything was, you know, VHS. So I was one of those tape traders. I couldn't get my hands on enough Japanese tapes. And then Norman turned me on to English wrestling. And then I'm, you know, studying Johnny Saint and Jim Breaks and, you know, all these guys. And I just, you know, I was one of those dudes that literally consumed wrestling. I ate it, I slept it, I drank it. Like, my life revolved around pro wrestling. And I knew at that point in my career, even though WWEF at that time was the place to be, my dream was to go to Japan, man. I wanted to go to Japan and wrestle in Japan. My dream was to become a gaijin legend, where I could go to Japan, you know, make decent coin, come home to the States, and nobody would know who I was except for the hardcore wrestling nerds. That was my plan, and WWE was an opportunity that came up for me. And usually it's the other way around, you know, guys go to Japan, you know,
yep,
and then get signed. But, you know, I had a few, you know, tryouts, and, you know, they used me as an extra a few times. And one day, John Laurinaitis, Johnny Ace, and I cornered him, and I said, hey, Johnny, can I get 5 minutes? He said, no, I'm busy. I said, can I get 2 minutes? He said, I'm busy. Can I get 1 minute, 30 seconds? And he said, all right, well, you got 30 seconds. I said, tell me what the fuck I got to do to get hot. And I saw the expression on his face change. And I said, tell me what you need. Tell me what I got. What do you need for me to get a job here? And I said, man, I'm rolling the dice. I'm going to put it out there and see what happens. You know, and he said, hey, we like you. We just don't have anything for you.
Mm.
Come up with something that we don't already have and get back to me. And at the time, I was working out on South Beach, doing a nightclub security at Mansion and doing occasional bodyguard work. And I would see these self-absorbed, pompous athletes who have never accomplished anything in whatever league they play in show up like the world owed them something.
Mm.
And, you know, the light bulb came on. That hasn't been done in wrestling yet. Mm. So I came up with this whole, you know, I came up with the whole MVP character and how he would dress and how he would talk and a bunch of different storylines. And Ricky Santana is a good friend of mine. And I met him down in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, he was an agent there under Johnny Ace for quite some time. At the, of course.
Right,
yep.
You know, he and Johnny were best friends going back to the territory days. So I told Ricky, I said, man, I got this idea for this character, and I want to tell Johnny about it, but I'm scared they'll steal my character and give it to somebody else. So Ricky said, all right, let me talk to Johnny for you, and I'll get back to you. He talked to Johnny, and man to man, you know, Johnny gave me his word. I gave him the whole deal on MVP. He said, package it up for me and send it to me. I did that, and I cut a promo. As a matter of fact, I cut two. One was a minute to show that I could hit a cue. The other one was about 4.5 minutes to show that I could fill time and keep it interesting. And shortly thereafter, they said, hey, we want to bring you in, have a look at you. And the rest is history. I got a job.
Well, we'll see now, boys and girls, young wrestlers out there, guys or girls, whatever you are that might have downloaded this and listened to this, that right there is an education to a guy who's persistent, who is hell-bent on success, and who took his career by the friggin' horns and didn't wait for anyone else to hand it to him, a guy who did not have a sense of entitlement, which triggers the shit out of me. You know, because I know back in the day I did the same thing you did, bro, in a different way. So what you did, when Johnny A says, no, I don't have 5 minutes. Okay, you got 3 minutes. No, do you have two? No. Do you have 30 seconds? Yeah, what's up? Boom, by the horns. What the fuck do I got to do to get a job? That's how you do it. And that's what you did, bro. And I didn't know any of that you just told me. And I've always respected the hell out of you. And I got even more respect for you now because that's being proactive. And even all the stuff that you went through, that you went over here in this podcast in your youth and all those tough times and negative things, you turned around and you made your life something very special, and you're still rolling with it. So I got to tell you, hearing your story is extremely inspiring for me, and I'm 47 years old and washed up. So hopefully, you know what I'm saying? So hopefully it inspires some younger wrestlers out there to not sit back and say, well, what about me? Where's my push? What are you going to do with me? Oh, let me steal this guy's gimmick. No, this is a guy who went and watched others while he was bouncing or working security and see these athletes walking around like their shit didn't stink, and he got an idea and he turned it into the character called MVP. Man, I love your story and I never heard it, and I'm so glad I got to hear it right here.
Oh man, I'm very glad to share it with you. And you know, the biggest thing I want to stress to any young up-and-comers or guys that want to get into the business, the thing I want to stress, I learned one lesson from Johnny Ace above all that I'll remember regarding the business. He asked, and I would watch him ask extras one question. And I answered that question inadvertently. But he would ask everybody one question. How are you going to make me money? Mm. That was a question he would ask, one simple question. And most guys couldn't answer that question. Or if they tried to, they'd come up with some convoluted answer. Well, if you put me over on Undertaker at a pay-per-view, and then I'll do this. Like, yeah, you're not even talking straight, yeah, man. Get out of here, you know? I actually heard a guy say that. I actually walked by a guy say, well, you put me in with Undertaker at a pay-per-view, and you put me over on him, and then we have a good program, and, you know, Johnny just, you know. The point is, what do you have that people are going to pay for? What is it about you that people are going to buy a ticket to see what you have to do, to hear what you have to say? Because any wrestling company, regardless of where you go, what you are trying to do is wholesale to them your product for them to retail it to a larger market. What do you have? What is it about your package that you're selling that people are going to want to buy? When you can figure that out, how to package what you have and make it presentable, then your chances of getting a job are that much stronger.
Totally agree, because it's about making money. You know, you hear fans say all the time about passion. Oh, this guy doesn't want to wrestle anymore. Oh, this guy does this move, or this guy does that. You listen, you could mark out as a wrestler all you want. At the end of the day, I know I got into this stuff to make money. This is how I wanted to make my living, and this is what I, you know, this is what I think a lot of guys wanted, why they got into this business, was to make money. I mean, dude, my goal was, like, during ECW or whatever, I'd go on TV and I would try to do things or say things or act a certain way that the guy who's digging holes for a living, who has 3 kids and a wife who can hardly pay his bills, is willing to spend a couple of bucks to come watch me at the local high school when ECW does a house show. That was my goal, you know what I'm saying?
Exactly. That's it. Make people say, hey, man, I connect with this guy. I don't have a lot, but the little bit I have, I want to go see this for my entertainment.
Word.
You know, and that's it. That's what it all comes down to.
It does.
And I think, you know, I try to tell young people, I did a seminar up at Santino School a while back, and I told the kids, I said, look, I'm not gonna work with you on bumping and hitting the ropes and holds. I'm going to talk to you about something that most of you guys never get a chance to learn, and it's about the business when you get past the glitz and the glamour of the production and, oh, I'm on TV and, hey, mom, look, I'm a star. When you get past all of that, the bottom line is this is a business. Buy and sell. And if you ain't selling, it's because nobody's buying.
Right. That's
and,
right.
And you're not going to get a paycheck. You're not going to keep a job. If people aren't interested in what you got, it's a business. You got to get a check to pay your rent, your car payment, your mortgage, your kid's school, or whatever it is. And I think the problem is a lot of young people coming into the business, they miss that part. They overlook that part. All they see is, I want to make it. I want to be on TV. I want to be a pro wrestler. They don't see the financial part, or they gloss over that until, you know, after they've been at it for a few years, they've had some injuries, they see how life goes, you know, and you went through it. I went through it. Every veteran that's been around for a while went through the starry-eyed days in the beginning where, hey, man, I'm just happy to be here.
Of course.
But then something turns over and you realize, wait, this is my career. This is my job. You know, like a lawyer, like a doctor, like a truck driver, like a, you know, trash man, whatever it is. This is my gig. And all the, you know, the glitz and the glamour, yeah, it's still there, but it's not what it's about anymore. It's about, hey, I got to do the best job that I can do for my career.
Totally. And you know, and in regards to the topic that we were talking about pro wrestling in Japan and the success of it and all that and your love for it, I got to ask you, speaking about that topic, I mean, all the success that that sport has had in that great country, and I've had the opportunity to be there a lot, as you have, and you still go. I mean, are you surprised that it still hasn't really exploded here in America? I mean, we just recently saw New Japan do their big pay-per-view, you know, here in the United States. We understand that. But what do you think it needs, if anything, to make it here in the United States?
Well, it's funny you say that. I love Japanese wrestling, and I enjoyed the Japanese commentary. At the time, I didn't speak any Japanese at all, and now I speak just functional Japanese. I can order us a couple beers and say what's up to some chicks, you know. but a lot of people who like the wrestling, for whatever reason, can't relate to it because of the Japanese commentary. But guess what? As I understand it, I believe New Japan is about to start on Axis TV, I think. And Mauro Ranallo and Josh Barnett are slated to do the commentary, from what I hear. So there's going to be a whole bunch of people introduced to New Japan Pro Wrestling with English commentary that I think will open up a lot of doors for them. The only downside to that is, I think, and this is something that I talk about the wrestling business in general, during the heyday, and you were a part of it, you know, you had 12 million people a week tuning in to watch wrestling on Monday night. Now you got 3 or 4 million tuning in to watch wrestling on Monday night.
Right. Well,
I just think what's happened with entertainment in general is now you have so many choices. You know, if you got cable, you got a few hundred channels. If you got satellite, you got a few thousand. You got streaming, you got Netflix, you got this, you got that. So you've got so many things competing for your entertainment time. And I think, you know, that's why wrestling isn't, while it's still hugely popular, it's not as wildly popular as it was. So New Japan's coming into the market as another alternative. I think they'll do well when people see it. But I think it's just a matter of, just too much entertainment. This is the information age.
Well, yeah, I agree, and you're correct. It's the internet. Obviously, you can watch, to your point, streaming. You can watch just any kind of sports entertainment, wrestling, MMA, whatever, on the internet, or video on demand type stuff, the WWE Network.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much pro wrestling program from you know, TNA to WWE to Lucha Underground to, you know, I hope that New Japan and has success due to how great the in-ring and the physicality of Japanese strong-style pro wrestling is. I really do. But, bro, but I got to tell you, man, here's the thing that I think is a little, that might be a little tough for them, and I'm not hoping against them. I'm hoping for them. I think that it's tough from a character development standpoint. Even though you have American announcers and a color commentator and a play-by-play guy, it's tough to develop those characters because those characters are not going to be bilingual and speak English to connect to the American audience.
Well, the beautiful thing is And as you know very well, one thing about all the Japanese companies is that they always brought in the gaiji wrestlers.
Of course.
They always brought in foreigners.
Yes.
And right now, New Japan is selling out. They're the hottest ticket in Japan because they got the Bullet Club.
Yep.
The Bullet Club is a group of a bunch of gaijin, a bunch of foreigners, American guys, that are wreaking havoc. AJ Styles is
Jeff Jarrett, AJ Styles, Jarrett's there. Right, yeah, of course. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, Jeff Jarrett was a late addition, you know. So yeah, the Bullet Club was originally Fergal Devitt and you know, let me see, Doc Gallows.
Doc Gallows, yeah.
Machine Gun Anderson, the Young Bucks, Tama Tonga, and Yujiro Takahashi. And then later on, they added Jeff Jarrett. But the original faction is what set this blaze going. And then when Fergal signed with the E, it was a perfect timing for AJ to come in, fill his spot. And, you know, they put him over as the IWGP champion, which, you know, I honestly thought that they would never put it on another guy, Gene, after the whole fiasco with Brock.
With Brock, yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I was surprised that, you know, they put it on AJ, but right now the Bullet Club is hot, and all their promos are in English. So I think that's something that American fans could relate to in terms of, you know, the English broadcasting and the promos. But the beautiful thing about Japanese wrestling is it's not as character-driven in the American sense.
Right,
the
right.
Guys don't cut 20. There's no 20-minute promo segments. Guys get in there and they fight. They
yeah.
work.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
all the guys that were my favorites, they were my favorites because of their work. I couldn't understand anything they were saying. Chono, you know, he's one of my all-time favorites.
Oh, yeah, love, yeah no doubt, no doubt.
I didn't understand a word he said. I just thought, man, this guy got style. I like this dude's presentation.
Badass.
I like this way.
Yep.
I like the, you know.
Yep.
So, you know, I was able to connect with him in that way. So as far as an American audience connecting with the New Japan product, you know, there are some strong American guys on there that they'll recognize and that they'll appreciate. But if you're a fan of pro wrestling, if you're a fan of in-ring work rate, then New Japan is second to absolutely none, if not the best in the world.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I remember, you talk about VHS tapes. I remember part of a big thing, like for me, my style was, I was a pancreas. You know, I would watch all those DVDs. Well, was it DVDs?
Yeah.
I don't know if it was DVDs. It might have turned to DVDs then in that era. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, but it was right around that time that VHS started
yeah.
to DVD.
Yeah, that UWF, man. I loved that stuff. I couldn't get enough. I had the opportunity years ago. I worked for like a small, like Bush League type of shooter group type thing. Me, Al Snow went, Dean Malenko's brother, Joe Malenko, and you know,
Joe Malenko,
we were trying to do like a kind of like a UWFI type thing. It didn't really take off, but my point is, you said before early in this podcast, you mentioned, I can't remember how you said it, I'll paraphrase, but I think you said something like about UWF, like a 75% shoot, I believe you said, and
three quarter shoot,
right. So I think that's a great point the way you said that, because that's what it was. I loved it. I knew it was a work. But I was hooked. I mean, you know, seeing these guys, I mean, just I mean, I'm sure you were a pancreas guy. I mean, awesome, dude. Awesome stuff, you know? And I think that, to your point, if you are a fan of in-ring physicality, the athleticism of work, guys smashing strong style each other, then you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it don't matter if you speak English or not. People are going to dig it.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is just my theory. We'll find out. But, you know, but here's the thing. As you've seen, you know, people are conditioned. And a lot of the time, people are going to like what they've been conditioned to like. And they're not necessarily going to stray out of their comfort zone. But, you know, like I know, hey, maybe you don't necessarily like something. And then the first time you finally say, okay, well, I'll try it. But, hey, this isn't half bad. Yeah, let me have a little bit more of this. So, you know, I think what New Japan offers as a product is something that is slightly different from what the average American fan is used to. And, you know, I tell people all the time, you want to see some top-tier pro wrestling? Go check out Wrestle Kingdom. Check out Tanahashi versus Okada.
Yeah.
You know, check
yeah.
out Minoru Suzuki against Yuji Nagata. You know, just like you were talking about, this incredible physicality, the athleticism, the demanding, you know, grueling 20
yep.
minutes that, you know, these guys put into a match. There's no show. There's no 20-minute talking segments. There's no backstage vignettes.
No.
There's like, hey, it's you and me, and we're going to fight, you know? And I love it.
I love it too, and I gotta tell you, man, I remember my trips to Japan back in you know, years ago in the '90s. I remember my first time there, dude. I worked. It was Kevin Sullivan was in the promotion. I'm trying to think who else. Yeah, I'm trying to remember who else were American guys that people would know. But it was small. Gypsy Joe. My first pro wrestling match.
Oh, Gypsy Joe.
Yeah, yeah, bro, was against Gypsy Joe at Corken Hall, and you know it was he beat my ass, bro. He just whooped my ass. I mean I was fighting back. I was doing my best. This old bastard just killed me. But the rest of the tour he loved me because I gained his respect. You know what I mean? And he kind of taught me, and Kevin Sullivan taught me. But anyway, my point about it is, what a lot of people don't realize, fans from America or the UK, that when an American or a UK wrestler, whatever, goes to Tokyo and wrestles, you know, there is not, like, you're not sharing a locker room, you're not going over a match. Dude, I remember all my time working for New Japan, I'd be in the Gaijin locker room, and the Japanese wrestlers would be in their locker room. Referee would go back and forth for the finish, and I'd get off a plane and drive 2 hours from Narita in a minivan, you know, you know the deal, bro. You know, not speak a word of Japanese and get in the ring with some dude in front of, like, you know, 15,000 people I never met in my life. Here we go. Let's have a 20-minute match. You know,
but, you know, that's the beauty of it, man. That's the beauty of our craft. That's the beauty of what we do.
That's
if
right.
You are good at this.
That's
if
right.
You have truly studied this craft and devoted yourself to it, you don't have to speak the same language. And, you know, people ask me all the time, well, when you're over there with those guys that don't speak English, how do you communicate with them? They don't have to speak English. They speak wrestling.
That's right.
That's all I need them to speak. Our common language is wrestling. You and I can go to Germany tomorrow and have a match with somebody. We can go to Spain. We can go to Mexico. We can go to Japan. Doesn't matter, because we speak wrestling. And that's the beauty of this craft. It's an international language. Tiger Chung Lee said it best. I teach you secret to business. Babyface, hands forward. Heel, hands back.
Wow, I never heard
that. Understand that principle? Yeah. And how simple is that?
It really is.
As long as you understand that principle, it doesn't matter where you go in the world. I had some buddies went to China a while back. Somebody hooked up a tour over in China. All indie guys. Nobody knew any of them. By the end of the show, you know, they told me that they had the crowd eating out of the palm of their hands, because it doesn't matter where you go in the world, everybody understands a hero and a coward.
Of course.
It's an age-old tale that's been told for thousands of years. This is the good guy, that's the bad guy. We like the good guy because he's brave and courageous. We don't like the bad guy because he's a coward that kicks you in the balls when you turn your back. That's not right. Everybody knows that. And voila, you know, as long as you stick to those principles, you got a match, and people get that.
Yep.
And, you know, I think that unfortunately, too many young guys nowadays, they don't know that, or they've overlooked that, and they're more interested in getting their shit in, as the saying goes, or, you know, hitting that crazy exotic, you know, triple Lindy move or whatever.
Right. Of course.
And they don't realize, man, we're telling stories, and the moves are just the illustrations. As a matter of fact, The Undertaker taught me that. He said, "What we do in the ring is we tell stories. The moves are the illustrations." And, you know, another guy who dropped a gem on me, Jerry Lynn. He said, "Too many guys are too busy trying to pop the crowd on a move rather than pop the crowd on a finish." And it's a story. You know, at the end of the movie, you want to get up and stand on your feet and cheer. Not halfway through the movie when, you know, the nuclear bomb goes off, everybody's dead. "Oh, that was awesome."
That's right.
And then an hour later, the guy rides off into the sunset. Well, hey, that was kind of anticlimactic.
Well, you're right. And telling the stories is key. And in Japan, especially because of the language barrier as wrestlers, American versus Japanese, you have to be able to tell the physical story. And I really believe, like, for me personally, it taught me how to be a better worker, because I was handcuffed and forced to be a better worker, because there was no communication. You had to do it through the physicality of your body and sell the right way or whatever, get your heat or whatever. And you know, a lot of people don't know, MVP, there's also, you know, wrestlers, and you know this, you might have experienced this, I know I did, they test you. A lot of Japanese wrestlers, when you're
Oh, yeah, bro,
they test the American guys, and it turns into a little shoot. I mean, I don't know if you want to share any stories or something that's maybe happened to you. I know something happened to me once, and motherfucker ended up in the hospital. That's all I'm saying. So,
hey, you got to do what you got to do, you know?
I'm just saying.
It ain't ballet, right?
No.
If somebody tries to take liberties with you, then, you know, you have to take care of yourself. In my case, I was fortunate because by the time I got there, you know, I had already had my time in WWE, and, you know, so they, and this blew my mind because I'm coming into a New Japan locker room and I'm seeing guys that, you know, I marked out for, you know, that I would study, Tenzan and Kojima and Yuji Nagata and these guys that were just, you know, my favorites. And I remember asking Tenzan if he would mind taking a picture with me. And I said, Tenzan, Shashin, daijoubu? And he said, what? You want a picture with me? You're a big superstar. Why you want a picture with me?
That's funny.
I'm like, dude, you're a fucking legend, man. No legend. I mean, yes. So that locker room was, man, all those guys treated me like gold, man. They were awesome to me. And the fact that I actually wanted to learn Japanese and was trying, they got a kick out of that. So they would also help me try to learn Japanese. So fortunately for me, none of the boys ever tried anything on me. They never tried to get cute, nothing like that. Not for me when I was in Japan.
Oh, bro, I had it, man. I came up a little different going there because I wasn't. I hadn't been in ECW yet. I hadn't been in WWE, none of that stuff. So, you know, it was like on a tour. It was, you know, guys like myself or, you know, Chris Benoit, you know, Dean and Joe Malenko,
yes,
both, you know,
sure,
Eddie Guerrero, all of us. I mean, so Chris Jericho, you know, so we kind of had a, you know, hang tight. And Scott Norton was there.
Yeah,
Norton was there a lot, and Tony Holm. And I remember one night I was working with a young boy somewhere, not in Tokyo, it wasn't Osaka. I can't remember the town. And they had this young boy try, and we were on a 3-week tour. Like 2 weeks into the tour, they had this young boy test me. I don't know why. And the dude just, he did. And he got me hot, and then we did some kind of a leapfrog spot. I turned around, homeboy just flat out jump spin kicked my face off. I mean, we're to the point that, dude, I'm talking about, I take a bump out of the ring. I'm like, all right, well, hold on, this isn't right. I'm grabbing my mouth, and the ref's counting. I'm like, I'm not listening to that shit. Each knee, some, whatever. Well, he's counting English, and I know he's counting. My head wasn't wrong, my mouth was. I'm holding my mouth, and there's something wrong, like, with my mouth. And I realize my fucking bottom row of my teeth are sticking through the bottom part of my lip. Like, and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So I had to pull my lip over my teeth, and the blood's pouring out. And then I hit the ring, neck bones, brother. So,
And there was some justice to be meted out, right?
Yeah. I got a little heat because he ended up going to the hospital. But I went crazy. I lost it. And Saito's like, oh, it's okay. You know, you shoot, but not too much. You know, maybe too much. You know, so, you know, but I, you know, but
yeah,
you know what?
Yeah. I was a Japanese style.
Yeah. You know, dude, you know
maybe,
how.
Maybe too much. Maybe a little too much. Huh?
Yeah. But, you know, I didn't just like you, man. I grew up in a place where you can't, you know, you can't disrespect somebody like that, you know, but I understood,
yeah,
you know, and then
business.
Yeah. And then it took them 6 months, then they booked me again. So anyway, no, but let me ask you this, bro. Do you think that, like, down the road, and I know you're always in great shape, and I've always loved the fact, and people don't know, like in TNA or even in WWE, like, you're a guy who has so much passion and respect, not just for the business, but obviously for your own development of your character, which is, I think, a huge part of your success, because you got to be passionate about your brand, and you are, and that's why you're successful. But I have to ask you this. I always wonder this about you. You think that when the time comes down the road, whenever that is, that you retire from the ring, would you rather retire here in the U.S. or retire in Tokyo?
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm 41 now, and even though I started the business way later than everybody else, or, you know, typically speaking, you know, I've made the promise to myself that, you know, I want two things. I want to walk away. I don't want to limp away. And on top of that, I don't want to be like those, you know, unfortunate guys who I still respect, but have overstayed their welcome. This business is physically demanding, and there comes a certain point when you got to leave it alone. It just demands more than you can physically give. And I don't want to be one of those guys that, you know, has been around too long. So now I got, I don't know, 2-3 years left, maybe. You know, I don't know. If things are going really good, maybe 4. But I don't plan on doing this beyond 45.
Right.
So, you know, my clock's running down now. I know my clock's running down, and I'm wary of that. And I've said that at this point, I would like to finish my career in the States with TNA. I'd like to finish with TNA. I'm very happy with how they've been treating me, how things have been going there for me so far. But I want my last match to take place in Tokyo. So in a perfect world, you know, I'll wrap up with TNA at some point.
Right.
And then if things go the way I want, you know, I'll contact the Japanese office and tell them, look, I'm ready to retire. And I just want one last run over in Japan. And if I can mess around, and you know, it would be perfect in a perfect world if I can, you know, work something out with the office where I come over there and get into a program with one of their up and coming guys, put the kid over at the Tokyo Dome, you know, let that be my last match, take my boots off, leave him in the ring, maybe even do the whole angle, if you beat me, I'll retire, you know?
Right.
You know, put over there one of their young guys and say, hey, look, I'll keep my word. You beat me, I'm out of here. That's it for me. And, you know, the proverbial take my boots off in the ring and thank everybody. And that's it, man. And when I'm done, I'm done. I don't want to do it anymore.
That, I tell you, I hope that all happens for you. I got a funny feeling it'll go the way you want it to go. I mean, I think you got that kind of respect, and you've earned that for sure, and I mean that. And, dude, I got to be honest. I don't think anyone – I didn't know you were 41. I know you got started a little bit later. You don't look that 41's not old. No, you don't. I'm serious. I ended my career a lot earlier due to, you know, bad injury, but – and I feel you. When you say you're done, you're done. I believe in that. If you could financially be done and be done – God willing, I hope so, and I'm sure you will. And but I think you got definitely a few more years, if not more than that. Well, let's talk a little bit about too. I know this has to do with Japanese pro wrest, but your music career and stuff like that. Let's talk a little bit. Bring some people up to speed on your background and all that stuff, and your success with that.
Oh, but the music thing is just a hobby, man. It's funny when people, you know, ask about my music career. If it was a career, I wouldn't do it because then it would be work.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I got a little studio in my house, and, you know, I heard Run DMC when I was in fifth grade or sixth grade, and that made me write my first rhyme. And, you know, it's one of those things where I love music. I love all kinds of music.
Right.
You know, jazz, hip hop, classic rock. You know, I like everything. If it sounds good to me, I dig it. And I just finally decided, hey, man, I want to start recording some of my own stuff. And I made, you know, I got a bunch of songs that I recorded and released, and most of them I released for free just because I enjoyed doing it. And I've had really, really good reception to most of my music. And you know, I got a little EP that I've been circulating now that it's not available online. It's only available at live shows, or if you're a friend of mine, I'll give it to you.
But, that's cool, yeah.
Yeah, it's just an outlet for me, man. You know, and you know, I was talking to Dixie about maybe in the very near future trying to do some sort of like a little mini concert. You know, maybe some over in the UK. You know, do a few songs after a show, like an after party type deal.
Oh, that's
cool. We'll see if we can't get that actually, you know, brought into fruition for my fans and people who enjoy my music. But if you haven't heard my music, you can go to bandcamp.com. And, you know, MVP, you know, like my song, my TNA theme song, Return of the Ronin, that's on there. I got a bunch of songs.
Well, yeah, I want to
Ronin MVP.
Let me tell you something. I'm mad at myself, man, because at the top of this, I made a note to myself. I wanted to mention to you, man, and I know you know this, you know, weeks back in November, I don't know the exact date, it was Godzilla's birthday. I know you're a big Godzilla fan. He turned 60.
Yeah,
yeah, he turned 60. What's up with that, bro?
Yeah. Yeah, I sent out a little tweet, you know, wishing Godzilla a happy birthday. You know, one of the cool things, when I went over to Japan, my very first feud was with Togi Makabe. And his nickname is the Unchained Gorilla. And his finish is the King Kong knee drop. So, you know, I started, you know, cutting some promos and sending it over there to the office and, you know, talking a little trash on Twitter, saying, hey, King Kong, Black Godzilla's coming to Tokyo to whoop your ass, you know. And then that Black Godzilla thing kind of caught on a little bit. And, you know, I learned, you know, I so in Japan, I'd be saying, "Ore wa Kokujin Gojira da," you know, like, I'm Black Godzilla. And the fans actually started catching on, and it would be, "Gojira! Gojira!" So I have upstairs in my house, I have one of my bookshelves, display cases, a whole bunch of Godzilla dolls that fans would give me, you know, because in Japan, you know, the fans like to give you presents.
Yep.
And, you know, I'd show up at different shows and fans would walk up with a little gift bag or a little box and MVP sign, presento, arigato gozaimasu. And you know, I'd open it up and there'd be a cool Godzilla figure. So I got a couple dozen Godzilla figures upstairs on display from fans that had given them to me. And it's funny because I have the entire Godzilla DVD collection, every movie they ever made.
Oh, that's awesome,
DVD.
Bro! That's sick.
Right there with all my Godzilla. Yeah.
My brother's the same way. My brother's 8 years older than me, and I grew up like I wasn't a big Godzilla fan because I was drowned with it because he was at the film. Like this was when they had like 8mm projectors, and he would have. I'm serious. He would have the Godzilla movies, and my dad would have to get them for him, and he would force me to watch because I was his little brother. You know, and it's like I had enough of Godzilla, but anyway, no, yeah. But he was the same way. He still collects. I should connect you with him. He collects all that stuff, you know, so he's a big Godzilla mark also. It's pretty funny. But, and even for some that haven't realized, I might have pointed it out on commentary, I believe your current TNA music, you could hear, like, I guess you put in the mix, like that Godzilla, that roar, whatever you call
that.
Yeah.
Godzilla roar. Yeah, that's one. I've actually put that in a couple of my songs, man, because that. My song Ghetto Strong Style, I was using that as the theme music for me and Shelton when we were tagging in Japan. So you know, I put that Godzilla roar. It's my little signature sound, you know, like, oh, shit, it's about to go down now, Godzilla.
I love it, bro. Well, look, man, I really love having you on here and just shooting the bull a little bit about your career and catching people up to what you've done in your life and your career and the popularity of pro wrestling in Japan and your expertise on that. And for those out there downloading this, listen, thank you for that. And also make sure you follow MVP on his Twitter, which is, you know, you do a great job on your Twitter, bro. It's at the 305 MVP. Bro, I'm a big fan of your Twitter. You put some good stuff out there, bro. You know how to tweet. You're pretty good at it. Yeah, I'm serious.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. I kind of, you know, it's funny because I was one of those anti-social media guys. I never had a MySpace. I wasn't into Facebook. Twitter could kiss my ass. And, you know, somebody said, you need a Twitter account, man. It's a good way to connect with your fans and to get your music out there. And all right. And now I'm addicted to Twitter. At first, I hated it. And now I'm addicted to it. But, you know, one of the things I like about, you know, my Twitter is that it allows wrestling fans. And I tell people periodically, you may have seen me tweet, like, hey, man, this is, you know, my, the MVP Twitter account, but this is me. So, you know, don't expect, you know, just a bunch of wrestling stuff on here because I'm going to give you my opinion about the world around me and my life and your life.
Right.
And everything else is going on. So, you know, I might step on some toes and I might offend some people along the way, but hey, you know, you're getting me. Unadulted.
Oh, yeah, no, you're totally, you're definitely, you're real on that for sure. And again, it's at the 305 MVP. You can check out MVP's Twitter account. And again, bro, man, look, dude, I appreciate you coming on. We got to have you on again, too, you know what I'm saying?
Hey, you know, before it's all said and done, man, you know, I need to sit in with you and Mike Tenay on some commentary, man, get a little three-man booth going. I need to call you out on some of your obvious prejudice against my squad, man.
Oh, God. Bro, really now? Bro, are you serious? Come on. I'm a big MVP, Mark. I've been putting you over since SmackDown. Come on.
I don't know. Every now and again, man, you know, you say some of my motives and some of my actions are questionable. You know what I'm saying? Coming from you? You of all people? You?
All right. We're going to have to see. You have to sit us down and yell at us. All right. You're right. I'm wrong. All right, bro. No, listen, dude. Look, I love you, man. I appreciate you coming on. Seriously. Thank you, man.
Hey, man, it was a good time. I appreciate it. And you know what? Let's do this again sometime, you and me, without the microphones, because if you and I don't spend enough time, you know, catching up, and you still got a lot of knowledge that you can share with me. I remember when I was at WWE, you pulled my coat a few times and put me up on some really good stuff that, you know, I listened to. And then that's one of the reasons, and on a final note, to the, you know, the young up-and-comers that might download this podcast and listen to it, listen to the guys that came before you. Because it might sound like bullshit at the time when they tell you, hey, kid, don't do that or do more of this or slow down. You don't have the answers because you don't know. You haven't been there. But when somebody who has been around longer than you that has actually made some money says, hey, let me pull your coat, listen to what they're telling you. And I want to tell you, thank you very much. You probably don't remember, but there are more than a couple times you pulled me to the side and gave me a little heads up and gave me some advice on a few things. And I listened to that, and I appreciate that. So you and I need to get together and do that again sometime.
Oh, I appreciate that, man. Thank you for saying all that. I do appreciate it. And I pulled you aside because I know how much you care on your talent and your abilities. And obviously, you're doing it big right now, bro. You're a rock star. And again, I appreciate you, man. And let's do this again. All right, bro?
Absolutely. You call it.
All right, man. I'll see you, man. Take care. Right out, bro. See
you. You too.
So let me ask you a question. You think we do the show for free, right? It's just like for free because you downloaded it.
Yes.
Well, it's time to pay the bills. Relax.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. Boys and girls, pull up your stools. It is now time for Taz Tales.
You know when you have like a really, really, really good idea, and in your brain, it's just like an amazing idea, and you go through with all of the energy and the effort and the time and the effort, the money spent, the contacts being made, the legwork, everything gets done, and you put your best foot forward and other people around you help you, and then the idea at the end of this long day sucked. So that's what happened with my finishing school that I had a couple of years back, for those that remember. I had this concept that I truly thought was unique, where I was going to take guys or gals who had at minimum 5 years experience as a professional wrestler. And they had to go through an approval process where I saw a video or on their wrestling, and I also would listen to and watch their promo work and basically say, we'll accept you, invitation only type thing. People from all over the country and world were basically, from all over the United States and the world, were applying to my finishing school. Promoted it the right way, got the word out there, had the facility, a place here in New York, bought a ring, had a private area, had a video viewing area for promo work, had all the legwork done, had a trainer, a guy who was going to do all of the, basically a general manager, and he's also going to be the trainer to work with flexibility, injury prevention training for these cats, you know, had everything done. But it flopped. The idea flopped because I felt like in my mind, I can't do this again. And I'm going to explain here why, okay? Again, the concept was I'm going to take wrestlers who have experience, at least 5 years, but are missing that finishing touch. What does, you know, TNA look for, or Ring of Honor, or WWE, or New Japan, or whoever, Lucha Underground, whatever. What are they looking for, right? What are they looking for? That it factor. What are they looking for? The way the guy or gal gets in the ring or looks around the audience, or after they take a bump, how do they sell that bump? After they do an offensive move, what do they do after that offensive move? You know, those little intricate things in a promo, you know, your eyes, your expressions, your hands, your shoulders, the way you move your body while you're cutting a promo, whatever the emotion's supposed to be that you're selling. Everything that they want or don't want out of wrestlers, I know what they want. I feel I'm qualified for that. I've heard guys get bashed and ripped in TNA production or agent meetings, or WWE production or agent meetings, or through my years in ECW. I know what pisses off the promoter that the wrestler did or didn't do. I know what other wrestlers get upset about if a guy or gal doesn't do in the ring or did do in the ring. So I feel like all my years, over 25 years, and everywhere I've been, hey, I'm more than qualified, and I've done this. I've main evented. I've been a world champion. I've made good money in the business. I'm pretty successful, humbly speaking. I'm proud of that. So it's not like I'm some ham and egger that's going to start this finishing school, and it's a money grab. That's not what this doesn't do with money. Well, it wasn't even expensive. It didn't work. It didn't work. And all right, so
the combing through process is like a needle in a haystack. Finding the right folks that you invite to this that apply. Okay, and that took a long time, and we did it. And I was very proud and happy of the folks that we brought in, of the wrestlers that we brought in, and most of them are all still wrestling. But what happened was, it's not that I gave up on them. I mean, I fulfilled my obligation to them, and gave them, if you talk to any of them, gave them just a plethora of my time, more than even what they have paid for. I've given them just so much time while I was doing this finishing school. And then a couple of them, I ended up saying to TNA, hey, maybe take a look at this guy, or you know, maybe I get a call from WWE about this guy. And yeah, you know, and I give the nod and say, hey, in my opinion, this guy's game ready. This guy's ready to go. This guy just needed a couple little tightening up, and we tightened him up, and he's ready to go. And, well, this is where the problem lies. You know, I never thought about people, basically some people getting that opportunity, and the nerves and the emotion of them, for lack of better terms, hate to say it like this, but choking, you know, and I never thought of that, because that was never like it was a foregone conclusion in my mind that I would never choke. And I couldn't control that emotion. I couldn't control when they would get an opportunity for a dark match, and now my reputation is on their name. So now if they can't, you know, hit the ball when it's thrown to them, well, that looks like that's a bad reflection on me. And I was proud of the tryouts and the in-ring performance that some of my pupils had with the TNA or WWE. But a couple of times, you know, physically it was fine, but it just the psychology didn't click and stuff like that. So that right there made me a little bit leery to keep going with this finishing school. That was one of the main reasons. The other thing was the mindset of the younger wrestler is the bigger thing. Like I combed through and found the right guys and girl. There was one girl involved that I kind of finished or polished up, for lack of better terms. And I was very happy with all of them. Okay, no problem. I still communicate with some of them. Proud of them. That's all good. One of them I think is going to do really well in the WWE, working as Bull Dempsey in NXT. And I think he's going to end up, once he gets called up to WWE, I think he's going to do really well. I mean, but I digress. So I do think that the mindset of the younger wrestler, now I'm stereotyping, which I hate to do, but I'm going to stereotype right now, okay? And for a bulk of the younger wrestlers in this generation of wrestler, I mean, there's a little bit of an entitlement. There's a little bit of a lack of a work ethic. And I know I sound like an old grumpy bastard, but so be it. You know, and there's a little bit of a, you know, it's not their fault. They're not getting a chance to learn on these independent shows from other true veterans. Like when I came up in business, I learned on the road in independence. They weren't even called independence, but in the Northeast, working for small promoters a whole bunch, learning from guys like Tony Atlas, learning from guys like Greg the Hammer Valentine or Hercules Hernandez, you know, I mean, or an Abdullah the Butcher. I mean, these type guys, you know. And of course, once I got into Eastern Championship Wrestling, which was ECW, the very beginnings of ECW, someone like Kevin Sullivan, who, you know, I will do a podcast or a Taz Tale, I should say, about Kevin Sullivan, who I have the utmost respect for and who I learned just so much from. But I'm just saying, like, I don't think these, in today's world, that's not happening. You know, these guys are not, they're not learning from those guys because it's a different world. A lot of these territories, I mean, just talking to some of the younger wrestlers, it sounds very frustrating what's going on the independents. You know, if you go wrestle for, let's just say, House of Hardcore, Tommy Dreamer's House of Hardcore, I've never been in one of his locker rooms. I've never been at any of his shows. But I guarantee you that the veterans that are on that show, from Tommy down, they are helping those young guys and teaching them the right way. Maybe I'm biased. So be it. I'm biased. But like something like that. NXT. A high level in House of Hardcore, obviously. NXT, they're learning the right way. You know, you got the right trainers there that Triple H has set up with the WWE and all that stuff. That's all there. And speaking of NXT and that performance center, a little birdie told me several years ago, without naming who that little birdie is, when I did this finishing school and pumped out the website and started doing the very beginnings of it, that somebody in WWE saw that and said, wow. And who would have thunk it? They had the money, the power, the penetration TV-wise, and they took it and called it a performance center. So if I'm tooting my own horn that I kind of gave them that idea, then toot. But whatever, it don't matter. I mean, they're obviously doing a lot bigger and better than what I did, you know. But it's cool. It's again, are we reinventing the wheel here with a polishing wrestling school? No, but I do know that someone there, and I'm not naming names because I'm going to keep my integrity, did see this when I did this a few years back and was like, wow, why are we not doing this? And they did it to another level, and hello, NXT. So, but back to my point. With the younger wrestlers, I really feel like they are not learning the right way as a whole. Again, I am stereotyping. Don't bash me. I know there are a lot of guys there that are great, that are coming up the right way. Don't get me wrong. But I just feel like in these younger, these smaller federations or independents or a House of Hardcore or, like I said, an NXT with all younger wrestlers, NXT, you learn the right way, but are you learning? They're homegrown and grassroots and grassrooting these guys, and it's all like cookie cutter. So is that a problem with NXT? I don't know. Maybe. We'll see as time goes on. I mean, I was taking with my finisher school people from all walks of life in the wrestling business, a melting pot, and then just kind of polishing them all up the same way. Not the same way in the cookie cutter, like taking their strengths and weaknesses, showing them how to hide their weaknesses, how to accentuate their strengths, that type thing. But doing promos with them and getting in the ring with them. And it wasn't a school where I was like, okay, let's go. Let me teach you how to do a tackle and a drop down and reverse the hip toss. No. If you didn't know how to do a tackle, drop down, hip toss, you were not invited to the school. That's how this worked. You know, you had to be way past that point. So I would take like little details and just nuances, and it was a very, very intricate school, and it was a lot of work on my part. And if you speak to any of those young folks that were there, they could tell you, every day I was there for a week straight, every single day for hours with them, just quality time privately in this big gym we had in New York, and we had a private section of the gym that was just for us. And that no one, you know, outside of myself and my general manager and the wrestlers were permitted and allowed in that area. So I got to bond with these guys and these kids and learn with them, and they learned from me and just got to know who they were. And then I would give them an evaluation at the end of it. And that's basically the way it worked. And man, I tell you, just as I'm doing this Taz tale talking about this, it still sounds like a great idea, but man, it's so hard, like, because the mindset's just different. It just, I guess I didn't have the patience for it. I guess that that's probably the long and short of it. I kind of ran out of patience with it, and not a knock on the ones that were there. I couldn't see myself doing it again because it was exhausting. It was just exhausting. And then once a couple of these folks got a chance to get a fastball thrown at them, maybe hit a ball as a home run or hit a ball as a double or triple, well, they were hitting, you know, they were flying out to, you know, pop-ups to second base, you know, a couple times. And it's not a knock, but it just happened. It's the truth. And I felt like I was just disappointed, not in them, just in the process. I felt like it was like my fault, and I couldn't control it. You know, I've had many bad matches in my life. I've had many really good matches. But when it was a bad match, it was my fault. I could fix it. It was me doing it. But when you're standing there as a quasi-coach and you can't get in there and fix what they're doing wrong in front of the people, in front of the TV cameras, and it's beyond your control, it's extremely, extremely frustrating. And that was another part of my problem with it. So, you know, that's basically the long and short of what happened with the finishing school. I guess I just ran out of patience, along with the mindset of the new age wrestler, and just an oil and water type situation. And well, that's that.
The Human Podcast Machine.
Oh, so you think we do this show for free?
Yes.
No, time to pay the bills.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Tiger style.
Tiger style. Yo. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. Death over they still high. What's I step inside the room? Dr. Joe, prepare for the...
All right, as they said in Five Fingers of Death, my favorite kung fu movie from back in the days, the match is over. For those that know the movie know what I mean. So that's it, man. That's this episode of the Human Podcast Machine. Special guest, I want to thank MVP, leader of the Beatdown Clan. MVP himself really gave us a lot of insight to his life, growing up as a kid, growing up the hard way, and his career from his work in Japan to WWE and into current in TNA and all his stuff, all his mindset. Great guest, MVP, the man, no doubt about it, my homeboy. And I want to thank you guys for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please keep supporting the show. Love it. We're getting great response. I dig it. And also, man, if you haven't, give a chance, download the Fantasy Draft Edition, where Mike Tenay, the Professor Vegas himself, myself, and my producer Seth, and we break down our opinions, three separate lists, top 10 current wrestlers of the world today. Give this a listen, man. It's a fun show. We really don't take ourselves serious. And there's a lot of different opinions online about who we picked or didn't pick. Give it a listen. There's going to be more Fantasy Draft Editions coming forward. We're going to do a all-time, best all-time, as opposed to current wrestler, all-time wrestler. We're going to do a tag team one. We're going to do a female wrestler one, best female wrestlers of all time type deal, or current. So there's going to be a lot of these Fantasy Draft Editions on the Human Podcast we've seen showing up. So give those a shout. Again, thank you for downloading and subscribing. I will see you next week. My next guest will be ESPN's own, the coach, Jonathan Coachman.